From the life as told by Diogenes Laertius, we learn that Plato had been raised in comfortable wealth in Athens. He had studied painting and poetry as a good boy ought. He had delicate sensibilities. And while he admired the theater and wished he could write drama like those passionate tragedies of Euripides, whom he dogged in his admiration, he himself had, it is said, a weak voice. None of his poetry was famous. None of his attempts at plays survive. While the old man was infamous in Athens, Plato had not followed Socrates at first. But as the controversy over him rose, he embraced his bitter wisdom, particularly the old man's distaste for populism, his contempt for how the riffraff was swayed by emotion and presumption and prejudice, and he admired how sharply his questions cut. Socrates, if we believe Plato, could bring any proud man to confess his convictions were complete ignorant error by this art of self-examining discourse. It was an overpowering method, like an emetic medicine. They had to cough it up every time. At least it must have been so practiced upon Plato. After Socrates' death, Plato wandered in search of another mentor, out of Athens, even to Sicily and Egypt. He nearly died on his travels, but was cured by Egyptian priests with ablutions of seawater. When he returned to Athens, he founded his academy and wrote. He was a changed man. He had become fastidious in manners of self-indulgence, declining drink or pleasures. He no longer admired poetry. He wrote dialogues in which Socrates spoke for him the truths he believed. Among these truths was that poetry appeals expressly to emotion and not to reason, and therefore deceives. Poetry does not tell truth. But while Socrates, if all else is to be distilled from the overwrought prose put into his mouth, was foremost a rationalist, Plato's own personal longings were mystical. Something learned from those foreign diviners, it seems. His theory of ideas held that beauty and love and goodness were qualities of reality that transcend experience, that they exist a priori and inform us, that we, like chrysalis, contain them before we are born and are born upon them. In this notion, he expounded his dense, lengthy treatise on the soul, in which the unlikely Socrates shall drone on and on for hours about such mystical truths. In obscure and ironically poetic terms that perhaps only holy initiates might comprehend. It is said that while Plato read it to his students, reading, it seems, for hours on hours, past supper time, each and every one by one, slipped away out of the house. Only the hard-headed Aristotle stayed to endure it to the end. And he would later try to reduce the soul to his theory of rational materialism.
You know, the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah. We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there. But can you still recall?
Plato, Millbrook, 1969. On the bare, round top of the mountain where the last glacier had scalped it, marking the rock with its melting claws as it withdrew without a sound in its slow, solicitous surrender. So slow it took centuries to let go, to retreat to isolation, to fall into its northern prison, where it lies lame but still murderous, and so enormous it fathoms icy waters too deep for life, where even the blind skeletal fish disappear, and is so cold that nothing is felt or remembered but of empty space. There, above it all, on that bare, round top, encircled by trees, there they stood, the three of them, two men and a woman, the guide, the seeker, and his companion. They looked out upon the splendid, spent August in the American Appalachians. The treetops stood beneath them, surrounding them, below the skull top of this rock, like a surrounding fringe to a tonsured head, and chased with winds, rasping and flickering with sunlight lacquered leaves. Except there was one tree on this bare top. One tree had penetrated a crack which had cleft this rock top. Into this crack, after the glacier abandoned it, and could barely see this lone peak as it drew away grudgingly, a single spore of opportunity, a solitary seedling in the deserted land, had insinuated and, growing stronger, thrust itself, and found root in a hidden, cavernous lake beneath it, like unto the cavity of a skull, where its roots spread across its dank ceiling with a grasping web, tended meticulously by albino beetles, and drinking deeply of the drenched, dripping air, it grew up, huge, a miraculous bowl and umbrella, at which remorseful woodcutters quailed. This unlikely tree sheltered a lawn comprised of its debris and centuries of fallen leaves, become a turf of thick, dark green mosses and tiny star-like white florets. And on that turf and under that tree, the Academy had built its tea house, modeled on the Japanese. It was the perfect spot for it. Electric wires had not been spanned up the hillside to the tea house, though they were strung along the highway, unseen because of the surrounding woods, which could be heard below the hilltop. Unseen cars, like unseen serpents, hissed along it. No, this was not the perfect panorama which Petrarch beheld, where men go abroad to admire the heights of mountains, the mighty waves of the sea, the broad tides of the river, the compass of the ocean, and the circuits of the stars. A radio played, breaking the intervals of wind song, coming out of somewhere among houses on the very next hills. Ramblers and mansions on horse pastures, all completely cleared of virgin growth 232 years ago, but which second growth had partially restored, as here, Its noise annoyed like a mosquito you cannot see to kill. Then coming again, they discerned it immediately across the valley from them, where now came the teeth-aching buzz of planks and studs sliced savagely to their precise measure under an electric power saw. From where a discouraging clear cut of this pathetic suffering second growth, cut to the ground, was being changed over by developers into more new houses going up. Beyond that, in the distant haze on a blue ridge once removed, the mountain showed fresh, raw scars of strip mining for coal. Like a ziggurat, like the terraces of an ancient earth mound pyramid. But this is no pyramid of sacred purpose. The guide pointed out these things in his strangely urgent manner, through his lipless mouth, and paraphrased Petrarch, "There men go abroad, yet pass over the mystery of themselves without a thought." When they entered the tea house, the noises ceased. The seeker sat as he had been taught on the reed tatami, designated for guests. The guide took the position of the host. In the central square tatami receded the dome of a cast bronze brazier, inside of which he lit a fire to make the tea. The guide announced that it will take a while for the water to come to the right temperature. The seeker was silent. His companion, sitting to his left, put her left hand over the top of his folded hands. As he waited, the guide carefully prepared the infusion. The person who was identified as a seeker had begun to complain when he arrived in his limousine. The price of this fucking thing was too fucking high, he complained. He had the money to waste, if it should prove to be a waste. But he was shot with stress, with exhaustion, with drug abuse, with frequent sexual adventures with celebrity, with public performances, with travel, and with his recent arrest. He was easily irritable, and he complained out of habit, and expected that those around him would soothe him, submit to him, and coddle him. However, it was the condition of the academy that the seeker must come alone. There was no one to assuage his nervous agitation, to stop his stuttering mind, to give him a pill or a hit, or even a sympathetic sigh. The seeker was young, thought himself beautiful, and he was. Thought his sexual prowess elite, and it was. He thought himself a priapic satyr, and pranced on stage as such. He believed he was a poet, symbolist, gracieuse fille de Pan. He sang popular rock and roll at public venues, which in the day had now become outdoor events as large as Major League Baseball games. The events had become festivals. The events had become rites of carnival and promiscuity and intoxication. They resembled, in the words of the syndicated press, lewd saturnalias. Police had become necessary. Where at first in California from whence this new paganism had emerged, the events had been lovely and intimate, but the summer of love had become the season of hell, he told them. He had the habit of picking his nose distractedly, and no one among his minion would remind him what his mother would have told him. The guide instructed him without reservation, however, and declared that should he wish to continue with the academy, he should spend several days first in purification, else the ceremony would be useless. He would obtain no benefit from it, but likely would be wounded, or worse, driven to a place in which false self-assurance should isolate him until the moment of a terrifying, lonely death. Saying this to him persuaded him to shut the limousine door, and it drove away, leaving him at the academy with no way to escape. Perceiving his compulsive self-importance, the guide ignored him. A functionary of the guide, a meek girl, who was more air than flesh, and who did not know who the rock star was, led him to a bungalow, speaking not at all to him or in a whisper. Because she would not look him in the eye and was so plain, he presumed she was overwhelmed to meet him. There was no TV in the room. There was no radio. There was no clock. There was no alcohol available. He was told the schedule of events, given a daily calendar. That evening, a guest would lecture on the subject of geological morphology. He was invited. He should hear the great bell call him. He declined. He fell on his bed, and he slept until the middle of the night. When he got up, he looked for a telephone and could find none in his room. He left the room, still dressed as he came, to look for a phone. There was no moon. There were no lights anywhere. The door to the main house was locked. He could see nothing inside or outside, except for the stellar stream above. The northern star, lopsided to it, hovering at the spire top of the house. Framed by the circular drive, surrounded by a dark wall of forest, like a battlement in the darkness. He went back to his room. He sat in a chair and cursed. He looked through his luggage for a joint or a pill. It had been searched before being brought to his room. He could find nothing. He flung a bottle of aftershave at the mirror over the credenza and broke the mirror, but not the bottle. He sat on the edge of the bed. He lay back. He fell asleep again. Late in the morning, the airy girl knocked softly but so persistently that he eventually awakened to it. She said something he barely heard and could not remember, but followed her. He still had not changed his clothes, nor bathed, nor brushed his teeth. His long hair was a rat's nest. He was taken along a footpath that went behind the academy's main house. In the moonless dark, the main house had been massive, formless. In the daylight, it was an old Victorian mansion. The spire, whose shadow had loomed upon him in the night, was a lofty, conical tower, gingerbread, frosted with fretwork, and sparkling silvery with bell-like wind chimes hung like tinsel along the eaves of the overhanging roof. The whole roof, he saw, sparkled and sang with them. And through prismatic, leaded glass, transoms on the window of the spire, beveled edges let sunlight in rainbows to shimmer, to dance against its ceiling. And looking down at him, from its widow's walk, with this sparkle of fairy light above and behind him, stood the guide. He receded when he was observed, looking down upon him as he withdrew. The several days of preparation bored him. He complained. They ignored him. he became sullen. He stopped complaining. He was too bored with sleep and isolation, so he began to listen to the lectures. He took walks. The food was vegetarian. He complained about this, but they ignored this complaint. Because he was not smoking, because they had taken his cigarettes, his taste for vegetables improved. The chef was accomplished with curries. He became interested in spices of curry. He took to spending most of his days in the kitchen. The chef, who was a Hindu, slight and dark, half-naked, wearing a poncho of homespun khadi, who said little because he knew little English, instructed him without a word on how to prepare the dishes, and tasked him patiently to grind seeds of mustard, cumin, coriander, and fenugreek into fine powders, teaching him by their taste to understand their subtlety, how when combined they achieved unexpected flavors. So this conjunction was also true, he noticed, with the combining aromas beyond the kitchen door, in the patchwork garden at its foot, around its corner, half shaded, half hot, where the Hindu crouched and taught him by silent example to harvest the low-lying herbs, to bundle them and to hang them in the kitchen near the top of the ceiling where they could dry. The warmth of the day brought forth the various flowers and delicate leaves. As the sunlight turned the corner where the kitchen door stood, bringing forth their aromas in daily signatures of the hours. The world by light and the world by scent blended gently. On the occasion of the seventh day, he came to the kitchen immediately in the morning and wanted to stay there all day. He no longer asked when he might leave. It pleased him now that there was nothing to say to the Hindu, who could not understand him, and that the Hindu said so little to him. It made their time together peaceful for both of them. If something needed to be communicated, the Hindu would wipe his hands with the folded hem of his poncho and approach him, smiling, and, more often than not, confine his expressions to gestures and example. Messages from his anxious agent and attorneys were ignored. Security prevented the entrance of anyone sent to the gate who was not invited by the guide. The agent threatened legal action in his exasperation, but he knew that the rock star had signed a binding agreement upon entrance. He could not leave until he was permitted, or he would forfeit a considerable sum of money, a penalty over and above the absurd expense for the abuse he had purchased. But he no longer felt it abuse. He no longer cared that more time had lapsed than he had expected. And the guide became more and more warm in his greetings to him, and sometimes visited the kitchen during the day to inquire after what he was doing, seeming truly interested. And the rock star delighted to explain to him the subtleties of curries, how they were similar to and different from so many other sauces and gravies that he knew. The guide asked very good questions. The rock star said he wondered as well and would try to find out the answer. And when the guide came the following day, or in another hour or so, he would be eager to tell him what he had learned. On the tenth day, the guide interrupted him in his contemplative task of grinding a portion of fenugreek. It had an aroma that then reminded the daydreamer of the smell of creosote rising from the railroad ties under the heat of the desert sun where he had once lived as a boy near an Air Force base in New Mexico where his father was an officer. He was remembering the color of his father's uniform from his glimpse of the sky. He was thinking of his mother's skirt from looking up to the window, from the point of view of what must have been a very small child on the floor, underneath a kitchen table. The guide, seeming to see these thoughts going on in his mind like a swarm of gnats about his face, said softly, "When you have finished this, will you please come to the solarium?" "Yes, sir," he replied, as he would have to his father. He could finish this later. He went with him at once. They pass around the back of the house from out of the kitchen door, passing through the crooked garden path among the trim herbs, and to the length of sheltered porch upon the estate's southern exposure, and the series of French doors upon it. "My mind is a maze of memory," he said to the guide, remembering then feelings as well as images of his childhood. "What are feelings?" he wondered more than he asked. The guide did not reply. "Containers, cisterns, cavities. It is how fantasy works. It is how the tale is told by the one who does not know the words," he is thinking as he walks. The guide says he should stop thinking now. He blinks at the emptiness and the darkness of the meditation room as they enter through a length of many French doors. They took off their shoes at the door. The meditation room is a large expanse lying in the very center of the house, on its north-south axis, facing the south. The porch of it, which had formerly been the airy solarium of the wealthy merchant who had built it in 1901, had been remodeled by the academy. The back walls of the solarium, which were shared with a sitting room and a library, had been removed. And the walls between those two rooms had also been removed, and the walls separating those two from the large formal dining room behind them at the heart of the house had also been removed. And so by restructuring these several rooms, one very large, long space had resulted, made more expansive by being entirely unfurnished. An empty expanse of polished hardwood parquetry on a short rise above the old solarium. And over the whole of this wide ballroom-like floor, a low, false ceiling gave the room a comfortable intimacy, and at its rear, a false wall of sliding rice paper shoji panels were installed, hiding the original dark wood paneled entrance and the lofty ceiling of that formal dining room, which became a dark antechamber in which they kept the accoutrements of meditation practice. The mats, zafus, bolsters, incense, cloths for polishing the floor, and so on. And, of course, their library of sutras. This large, unfurnished space should possess a cave-like aspect, except that once one was accustomed to its natural light instead of its darkness, the room was possessed of the light coming into it and its facing view. The room was bathed by the sumptuous image that it beheld. Beyond the open French doors of the porch, from where the breezes came into it, the lush green lawn flooded the falling hillside to the curve of a calm lake. Its near shore of reeds and cattails, a curtain of birch trees on its far shore, poised above the receding valley, which plunged beyond it. The smoky blue ridges of Appalachians limned the distances. Once his eyes were used to it, the room was therefore not cave-like at all, but a vivid present, a position in clarity of awareness. Here, looking out the open windows, his thoughts went out and away with the wind. On a low, central cherry wood altar, on the raised central dais at the center of the rear of the meditation room, three incense sticks in an earthen bowl of white sand let long lines of dun smoke lift without perturbation, thin as hairs, into the air. Next to it, off-center, was a single ikebana, derived of elements of the landscape before them, imbalanced harmony of the simplicity of an endless line. In front of it was the black zafu of the guide, upon which he now sat, motioning for the seeker to sit on another identical to it beside him, beckoning him to join him in looking out upon the lawn. He said nothing. After a length of silence, the shoji screen slid open behind them, and soundlessly, a person in stocking feet emerged with a zafu and sat on the other side of the guide. He could sense, by smell, and by some feeling, that it was a woman, a young woman. The three sat in silence. After a length of silence, the guide spoke through his lipless mouth, somehow speaking without moving his mouth, as it always seemed. "This is your companion.